Welcome to the Open Adoption Project. This is episode 119. We're the Nelsons. I'm Lynette.
And I'm Sean. And in today's episode, we talk with Beth Syverson, who is an adoptive mother and an author. And in this episode, we are going to be talking about suicidal ideation and suicide. So if that's triggering for you, you may want to choose to stop listening to this episode now. And Beth will talk about this in the episode, but in 2019, her adopted son, Joey, was hospitalized with a mental health crisis, really. And while there, Beth discovered that he had been using cannabis, some psychedelics, and more. This episode talks about that experience and what she has learned as an adoptive mother to help Joey to cope with trauma that's connected to his adoption. He was adopted when he was 7 months old from Japan.
And in this episode, we are sharing an interview between Alicia Gallagher and Beth. Alicia's been a volunteer with the Open Adoption Project, and we are so grateful for her and the time she spent talking to Beth and gaining this really powerful information for us.
Hey, we're here with Beth Syverson, the author of Adoption and Suicide. Beth, I am seriously so excited to talk to you. This is such an important topic, and you have written about it so beautifully, really.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for letting me on here and for being willing to talk about this tough topic. I really appreciate it.
Yes, of course. And I just, to start off, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about your story for those who have not read the book. Tell us about Joey, because as I was reading through it, it seemed like I wonder if you divide your life into a few parts. One of them is before Joey started struggling with suicidal ideation and after, and just the dramatic way that your life changed. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the before, and then we can talk about the during and after.
Yeah, that's a very good observation. Yeah, my life does kind of start and stop on February 7th, 2019, when he had his first crisis. But yeah, before that, so I adopted him with his adoptive father, who I later divorced. But we adopted him from Japan as an infant. And he was the most cute and cuddly and happy baby. And we just thought we won the jackpot. Well, I still do think we won the jackpot with him. He is really amazing, but he was just a vibrant, hyper, but in a good way, like just like alive child. Just, he was a great athlete. He was a musician. He is. I shouldn't be talking about him in the past tense here. But his childhood was just, from my perspective, he was an amazing kid, and we were so proud of him. And we thought everything was just good to go. We thought he was fine. And turns out he really, really was not fine for quite a long time. But I was super naive about adoption. I didn't know about adoption trauma or about relinquishment trauma or about any sort of attachment issues. I didn't know anything. They didn't tell us anything. In Japan, like literally they didn't speak English, the people that we adopted him from. And they weren't about to give us like a handbook or some sort of manual. I mean, there really isn't one that exists anyway, but so I was naive. I wish I knew a whole lot of things, but I didn't. So now that's one of the reasons I'm out, you know, with the podcast and with the book and trying to help other adoptive parents and families and teachers and therapists and people understand adoption's complexities better, because man, I wish I would have known. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's what I appreciate so much about your book, is that you don't by any means paint yourself as the hero, that I knew everything and we did everything we could, and yet he still struggled. Like, the honesty that you're bringing, I think opens the door for a lot of other adoptive parents to realize that there is a lifelong education that they have to engage in.
Yep. Every day I'm still learning. I still am paying attention as closely as possible to other adult adoptees that are willing to talk about their path and their struggles and their healing. Yeah, there's so much. And, you know, we parents like to be right, and we like to make our kids the ones that are, you know, a mess. And can you please just fix my kid? And that would be sure nice, honestly. Right. But it's a family problem. When you have someone that's suicidal, it's not that person's problem in some sort of isolated bubble. It's a family problem. It's a systems problem, even like a cultural problem. Like it involves everyone. So the message of the book, I hope one of the messages is that all of us need to do our work, and especially adoptive parents. I think we have an extra obligation to do our work because we have taken on this child that came to us with trauma, no matter what.
Yes, exactly. And can you tell us about that first suicide attempt? You were with Joey. Just take us through that story.
Yeah, so he was 15 years old. I got a call from his dad saying, "Beth, Joey's okay, but something really bad happened." And he tried to unalive himself at his dad's house. I won't go into the details about that, just because I don't want to trigger other people. But I had to run down there, like obviously drop everything, run down there, and try to navigate this mental health system that our country has, which is not great, and really has no idea what to do with teenagers, and really, really has no idea what to do with adopted people. That never even came up as a question. No one ever even asked no one asks on any sort of intake form, "Do you have attachment issues? Do you have any relinquishment in your childhood?" In fact, there have been many therapists and psychiatrists along the way that have said, "Oh, his adoption, that has nothing to do with it. He was a baby. It's fine." So, and I was clueless too at the time. So I'm just like, "Oh my God," trying to save my kid's life. And I was freaked out. And I thought, "Okay, all right, we'll get him in this hospital. I guess he'll stay there for several days. I don't know how this works, but they'll fix him. They'll take care of it. And he'll come out and he'll be fine." And while he was staying in the hospital that first couple of days, we found out, they do blood work, and we found out that he had cannabis in his system and alcohol and psychedelics. And I was like, "What?" I had no idea my kid was using anything. It turns out his dad had been providing him with cannabis and money for whatever he wanted, all he wanted, since he was 13. So that was really, really bad news. Really, really bad news. And I was just in a state of shock and dismay. And I thought, they'll fix it. He'll spend, 10 days in the hospital, and he'll come home, and he won't be needing those drugs anymore because they'll fix whatever was causing that, and we'll be good to go. I was like, "Whoo, dodge that bullet." But oh goodness, I was so so wrong about that. So he's 20 now, almost 21, and still struggling with cannabis. Particularly if anyone tries to tell you that cannabis is not addictive, that is, whoo, for some people it is extremely addictive, especially at the rates that the kids are using it now, and the dabbing and the high percentages of THC that's in the stuff that the kids are using nowadays. And we're in Southern California, and they will deliver it to your house, and it's like super everywhere. Every strip mall on every corner has a weed shop, and they're happy to serve minors, and they're not supposed to, but so it's been a really, really difficult environment for him, and he's just been on the struggle bus, and I have too. I've been trying to, like I said on our podcast, I'm walking along beside him while working on my own personal growth and healing, and it's been quite a journey. And I'm literally super grateful for it. Terrifying as it has been, it has pushed both of us and my whole family forward, and learning and understanding more deeply what's going on.
That's such an intense way to come to realize the struggles that he had been having, because it sounds like there was a lot of stuff going on underneath the surface that he might not have been expressing, or because of your like the lack of education that you had experienced, you weren't attuned to. So what were, looking back, what were some of those red flags, if there were any, that that with the knowledge you have now would have been more alarming at the time?
Yeah, certainly I missed red flags. And he is my only child, and so I didn't have anyone to compare it to. And I thought, "Oh, I guess this is adolescence. He's kind of sullen, isolating. He spent a lot of time in his bedroom. I thought he was just masturbating all the time. Maybe he was doing that too, but it turns out he was, using LSD in his bedroom all by himself, and which is extremely dangerous. And I don't know if you know what DMT is.
I don't.
DMT is another psychedelic, and it's extremely fast acting and strong. It's like, because LSD like is an all day kind of thing. You're like, whoo, for like 8 hours. Well, DMT, you go up and down in like 20 minutes. But
Wow.
it's very volatile and can make people do kind of crazy stuff. So it's dangerous to do by yourself for sure. And without, a guide or without someone helping you. And he was not doing it in some sort of spiritual, personal growth mode. He was like trying to literally get out of his own mind because his mind was so disturbed and upset, right? Because of adoption trauma and stuff, life. So the isolation, his grades dropped. He wasn't playing as well in baseball, and along with all of this, he was getting bullied badly, but we didn't know that either. And just the he just shut down. Like anytime I drove him to school, which took a 45 minute, it was a 45 minute drive, he would just sleep the whole time. So he would just like go into his cave. And it turns out he, like many adoptees, well, like many of us, he was a people pleaser. He doesn't want us to be upset. He doesn't want to get in trouble. And so he just tried to put a mask on and just pretend everything is fine as things were kind of falling apart around him. And then at a certain point, he's like, I can't do this anymore. And then the suicide attempts happened, and then here we are.
Well, the drug use that you're describing, it he's looking for an escape. In the book, I love that you include excerpts from him in the book so that we hear directly what his experience was like. And there are a couple of things that stood out to me that he describes it as nothing was as important as stopping the feeling that I was feeling in the moment. I just wanted peace. And so that's just such a crucial part of this, that it's not that an adoptee that's struggling with this doesn't want to be here. They just don't know how to get away from the discomfort.
That's right. We talk about the suicidal part in the book and in the work I do. A lot of us have a suicidal part, and it's we I believe, and if you know anything about parts work or internal family systems, there's no bad parts. All of our parts are trying to help. Like in the movie Inside Out, it's kind of like that. Like all of those characters in our brains are all trying to help in our own way, in their own way. So that suicidal part was like, oh man, bud, you are in so much pain. Let me help you out with that. And it didn't want to kill all of him, like to kill him, but it wanted to kill the pain and get rid of the pain and kind of like put him on high alert. Dude, something has to change. This is not working for us here. So thank goodness his suicide attempts, and he's had, oh God, probably 8 or 10 of them along the way. None of them have been complete, thank goodness. And he just keeps going day after day after day, which I admire him greatly for. And I should have said this towards the beginning, but I guess obviously because he co-wrote the book with me, he wants our story out into the world. And I told him I was doing this podcast, and he said, go, mom, just go do it and share our story. So I want everyone to know I'm not telling his story without his permission and his blessing. And if he was in more stable place, he probably would be here with me right now. Maybe someday he will.
Yeah, and I'm so hopeful that that will happen, because just the collaboration that you two have is, I mean, it takes away the shame that can just double down on those feelings of you feel guilt and shame for wanting to not be here, and then it just makes it worse. You withdraw even more and more, and so to just shed light on it is it just so healing for so many people that are going to be able to hear this and read your book.
Oh, I hope so. That's our deep, deep hope is that it helps a lot of people. Thank you.
So after you learned kind of baptism by fire, really, like, now I have a child in crisis, I need to learn everything I can about what he's experiencing, what he has been experiencing and not verbalizing. What have you since learned? What have you been able to do that you felt like has helped him in this experience that he's been having?
Yeah, an adoptee acquaintance of mine, you know, sent me to The Primal Wound, which is kind of a book that a lot of people have kind of discovered adoption trauma through. Now I think I recommend a book called Adoption Unfiltered. It's even, you know, it's more updated. The Primal Wound by Nancy Verrier is, you know, over 20 years old. And so this new book called Adoption Unfiltered, it's an adoptee, a birth parent, and an adoptive parent together. And they have a lot of adoptee voices in there. And I think it's even better and more up to date. But so I just started digging in. I read the Primal Wound. I got an adoption therapist for both Joey and me. I watched a wonderful film called Reckoning with the Primal Wound by Rebecca Autumn Sansom. And things like that. Listen to podcasts. Adoptees On has been an amazing resource with Haley Radke. And, you know, just kind of like diving deep into adoption trauma. Like, oh my gosh, what did I not know? So it's been very helpful. And I also, for the first year, ran Joey to every person I could find that would do anything to help him. You know, psychiatrists, adoption therapists, gurus. I was like, whatever, if you can help my son, here you go. And that made us both kind of crazy, you know, running him around, trying to fix him, like, please fix my son. And so at a certain point, I got a life coach who specialized in helping parents with addiction, with children that have addiction. Her name's Heather Ross. She's amazing. And she helped us greatly. She helped my wife and I to turn the spotlight off of Joey, which is super uncomfortable for him, and turn it on ourselves and go, okay, what's going on with us? How can we get ourselves as parents more regulated and calmer so Joey can have a safe place to land? And so we can, you know, provide some more stability instead of us all running around like chickens with our heads cut off, you know?
That is a very interesting point you bring up, because it sounds counterintuitive, I'm sure, to a lot of adoptive parents and a lot of parents, period. Because especially when your child is in crisis, it would make sense, you would think, to make it all about them. My needs come second. Whatever you need right now is the most important thing. So, and even saying that out loud, it doesn't sound quite right. So tell me a little bit more about what that exploration has been like for you and your wife.
Yeah. Well, it's a cultural expectation of parenting. You sacrifice yourself. You sit on the baseball sidelines, you know, 5 nights a week, and, you know, you do whatever you need to do for your kid, and you just lay yourself down. And that's not great. Mm-hmm. Not a great cultural narrative. So more about, you know, that when you get on an airplane, they say, you know, if the oxygen masks come down, use it on yourself first and then help your kid. Because if you faint because you can't breathe, then you're really no good to help your kid. So you've got to maintain your own composure first. So regulate yourself first. So that was a big shift for us, but it turned our family's ship around quite rapidly, actually. And we're still struggling. I don't think this struggle will ever end, honestly. I think it'll be something that is, you know, does any struggle ever end? Really, we just kind of learn to deal with it better. And I really hope that Joey will find some more stability, but I don't think we'll ever say, oh, whew, glad we got through that one. I think this is going to be a lifetime of learning and growing for all of us. This adoption thing is not just one thing that you did at one certain point. It is a lifetime of learning and surrender and growing.
And what are things that you do now? How is your routine different? How is your self-care different? And how have you noticed that impact the way that you support Joey?
Oh, thank you. Good question. It is radically different. So I do a whole bunch of things to keep myself regulated. I meditate every day. I've been working on mindfulness just as a general, like staying more present in my own emotions, kind of being able to watch myself from above, like, oh, you're doing that thing again, aren't you? God bless you. with self-compassion, but oh, there you go again. That kind of thing, mindfulness. I picked up drumming. I do taiko drumming, which is a Japanese art form. I wanted to do it with Joey because I was trying to connect with his heritage. I'm white, in case you're just listening and don't look at my picture. I'm white, he's Japanese. And I thought, oh, we could do it together. And when you do something as a mom of a teenager, that thing is no longer cool for the teenager.
Oh
So sadly, he doesn't do it with me, but I enjoy it greatly. It gets a lot of energy out, and it's fun, and it's a nice kind of a hobby for me, but it's very therapeutic at the same time. And oh, I've been work, I go to therapy, I've done EMDR, I've done brain spotting, I've done internal family systems work, like going into my own stuff. I'm not talking about Joey in those sessions. I'm talking about my own stuff, my childhood stuff that's been pulling up because of what's happening with Joey and just because of life. So it's extensive and it's never gonna end either. This journey that we're on, it's intense and it's beautiful. It is Joey and I, despite all of our struggles, he and I are closer than ever. He's able to tell me all sorts of stuff. I ask him at least weekly, what's your SI today, as in suicidal ideation, like on a scale of 1 to 10, how suicidal are you today? And he just shoots me a number, and usually I just say, oh, okay. Usually it's like 2 or 3. And it's almost never zero. Sometimes it's a zero, but it's almost always 2 or 3. And then sometimes it goes way up, but it hasn't for a long time. So anyway, he and I are able to talk about things deeply, really tough things. We're more open, and I've become more open and better communicating with my wife, and just things seem to be pulling together.
I so admire the humility with which you approach this, of just instantly realizing that I have to help him. I have to change the way that I view myself, the way I view our relationship, the way I'm viewing life. And everything needs to change. Maybe not everything, but so many things have to change. And for you to just accept that reality and go with it, I'm sure that wasn't easy, but it's a really good example for any adoptive parent that something might come up and you're going to have to pivot almost immediately.
And something like suicidality, it doesn't give you too much choice in the matter. I guess I could have I guess I could have buried my head in the sand, but it just seemed like it's like life or death. Okay, what do I have to do? And the universe or whoever answered and said, here are some people I'm going to throw into your life. I got in touch with Heather through a friend of a friend of a friend. Just people kind of get drawn into your life that you need at a certain time. And so I'm very grateful to all those people along the way. And yeah, just the more you fight against the reality of whatever's happening, the harder things go. And if you go, okay, my son is suicidal, that sucks. What is my role here? What do I do? What can I do? Do I have control over him killing himself? Absolutely not. There's nothing I can do. If he wants to kill himself, I have no power over that unless I'm standing right next to him and can, yank some weapon out of his hands. So that leaves me. That leaves me. What can I do? What can I do to be a warm and accepting, safe place for him to come to? Because parents, if you are freaking out when your kids are suicidal, that does not help. We don't need to freak out because they're already freaked out. So it takes so much work and it's a daily practice. Honestly, I'm still working on this to stay calm no matter what your kid brings you. Say, oh, you're feeling suicidal today. What do you need? How can I help you? Do you want to just talk about it? Do you want me to just sit here and listen? Do you need me to get help? You want to go out for a walk on the beach? And to be able to stay in that place and stand with your child or somebody else that's suicidal, it's super, super hard, but that's what they need. They need to be listened to and acknowledged. And I want to just say that throwing them into an ER or throwing them into a hospital is not that effective.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because that is a you it sounds like you could write a whole other book on just that. I love that you are just so honest about what his experiences were like. And then in his own words, there one of the accounts he describes, I think his most recent one, that he got really upset, and then a doctor came in and said things that made him just feel more shame.
Oh.
And he and Joey's words, he said, "I just wanted someone to say, we'll help you." That's all he's wanting. And so what you're describing in that conversation with him when he's describing any suicidal ideation he's having that day, and your response being, "How can I help you?" is I can imagine that just being a healing thing to hear from his mom that I'm here for you. I will help you. And you just want more people to respond to him that way, I would imagine.
Yes, that's what they need. That's what that suicidal part needs. And if a person that is suicidal can even develop that within themselves, oh, I hear you, suicidal part. What I hear you're loud and you're like a bright blinking light. What do I need to do? That is where the healing comes. It's not throwing you into some sort of isolation, some sort of jail like 5150, psych hospital where they just literally just throw you in there and just like say stay there and they don't help you. It is listening. And that it was a hospital chief that did that to my son. Well, yeah, it's in the book, but he punched a hole in the wall of the ER, which is not great. But he felt like a trapped animal because of the way they treated him. And he was in there for suicidal ideation. You would think that they would be gentle and patient and compassionate with a person like that. But no, this hospital chief came and said, "I know kids like you. I know you're just looking for attention." And
Oh my God.
part of me is like, yeah, you know what? He is looking for attention. He's looking for somebody to say, "What can we do for you? You obviously are very hurting. Is that such a horrible thing? Is that the end of the world for somebody to be seeking attention?" But the way that he said that, and at the time, my son was restrained, which is probably a really, really, really good thing. But that completely traumatized my son. Like, it would have been better for me never to have taken him to that ER because it made it way worse. So I'm not going to take him to the ER again.
Yeah, in the place of that, because I think any parent who's maybe experiencing this for the first time, that's the only place you know where to go. You
I
find
know.
psychiatric
That's
unit.
where they tell
So
you to go.
yeah,
What
so
I would
anyone
do
places that.
now. What I would do now, I have called 988, which in the US is the new number to call for mental health crises. 988 is great. Every time I've called, they've been extremely compassionate. They don't call the cops on you. They don't say, "Run to the hospital right now." They know how to de-escalate things. So call 988. They're very good. And it's better than calling 911 because 911 people come with guns, and we do not want guns anywhere near a suicidal person. So my son has almost attempted suicide by cop before. Are you familiar with that, what that means?
Oh, yes, but describe it for anyone who's listening that might not know.
It's when a person goes after a cop's gun and they don't like that, and then they might shoot you. So it's kind of a way to kill yourself by threatening a cop or by trying to grab their weapon. So it's terrifying. So I don't want any guns near anything when he's feeling like that. So 988, no guns. They're like super trained in crisis intervention, and so they'll calm you down, and they can send out people that are trained like social worker type people without guns. So I would call 988, but mostly what I would do now if my son was suicidal, like if I called him and said, "What's your SI?" and he would say 8, I'd be like, "I'm coming right down." And I would sit with him. I would take him probably out for a walk, do something outdoors, something with some exercise in there, some movement. And I would not leave him alone until I was sure he was stable again. And I would just talk. We would just talk. Maybe eat. Sometimes he gets really off, reg deregulated, dysregulated when he doesn't eat or when he doesn't sleep. Kids sometimes don't do those real basic things, and it can get you kind of wacko. So I would make sure those basic needs are met and just sit with him until he was stable.
And going back to something you said earlier about the people that you found that have supported you, did you feel like you had that support system already? Or did you have to start vocalizing everything that was happening to friends and then people got connected with you? Like, how did you go about creating this support system for yourself?
Yeah, I did not have a support system at all. I was super clueless about everything. I was just working and parenting, working, parenting. I was just doing the thing, kind of the grind, that everybody does. And so, no, I had to collect all these people. And it was tricky because when your son tries to kill himself and then you figure out he's been using drugs, a lot of your friends like disappear, especially friends with teenagers. They're like, oh, hell no.
Oh man,
I don't want this to be contagious.
which
I
just
can't deal
doubles
with this.
down the isolation for you and for him.
Yes. People are scared of us. Honestly, I probably would be too. I don't blame them at all. I'm not judging them, but it's a lot. It's a lot to take care of and to handle. So, but it is not contagious, I just have to say. But no, I had to kind of reach out and I just dug into the internet and asked people for help and like just I don't know, the right people just dropped into my life. I think that the universe helped a lot and just said, here you go, here are some guides, do what they say. And at a certain point you have to just say, I have no idea. I have no idea. Tell me what to do. And then luckily some really beautiful people came and helped me out.
And the compassion that's required of you to be with Joey in these moments, do you feel like you were already that kind of person that could be present and compassionate and understanding, or did it take a lot of work to get to the point where you are now?
That's a good question. I would like to think I was, but I was not real great at handling emergencies or high intensity situations. I'm kind of a sensitive person. I tell my family I'm a flower. I can't watch horror movies or I'm just like I'm very sensitive, and so it's been a very big journey. But I've come a long way since, 6 years ago. But yeah, at first I was flipping out and just like, oh my God. What I do, and it's a flight response, if you know fight and flight, all those different trauma response, flight response is not just leaving, it is getting super busy. It is kind of intellectualizing things. It's leaving your stressful situation and replacing with something else. And so that's what I did. I was like, what can I do? Let's make a chart. Let's make a list. We're going to call all these people.
What can
And
I control in this out
yeah,
of this situation?
I was very much a control person. And I was like, don't worry, mama's got this. I'm going to get you the right expert. I'll find you the right treatment center. I'll find you the blah, blah, blah. And I guess that was better than nothing and better than just saying, well, go figure it out yourself. I mean, I guess it could have been worse, but it just amped up the whole situation. It didn't help him feel more heard or understood. It made him feel like a project, a broken person, and he's not broken. He's responding exactly how a person would respond with the amount of trauma that he endured in his especially very young life. It sort of makes a lot of sense. So it helped a lot when I was able to calm my own system down and get myself more regulated and come at it with a calmer situation.
That's really great. And the another thing about the book that we haven't mentioned is that in addition to talking about your experience and Joey's experience, is that you include contributions from 14, is it, people who have who are adoptees who have struggled with suicidal ideation or their birth parents, they're connected to this topic in some way, and they've contributed essays and poems. And I love that you did that. That is such a creative way to create a sense of community and not just you telling your story and this is it, now good luck, but for people to connect with some artful expression of what they've gone through to lessen that feeling of isolation. It's almost like you're saying, if this is happening, you need to talk about it. You need to connect with people who have experienced it, and you can find healing there.
Yes. Oh, I feel so seen. Thank you so much for figuring out what we were trying to do there. Yes, we wanted to elevate more adoptee voices. That was one big push for that. And so I think 11 of them are adopted people. And then there are three birth parents in there. Two of them lost their child to suicide after reunion, which is just devastating. And then there is an adoptive parent in there besides me that has, she unfortunately also lost her child to suicide. So all of those voices combine and create this tapestry of pain and healing and hope and community. And we're continuing because I am bringing them along with me, and we go to speak for different organizations, and we have a monthly conversations about adoption and suicidality that we're hosting. We just had one on Sunday, and it was the most beautiful. We had 9 of us, 3 birth parents, 3 adoptive parents, and I think 5 or 6 of them are adoptees, because some of them are more than one thing. Mm-hmm. And so we had all the sides, and just witnessing an adoptive parent who lost a child talking to a birth parent that lost a child. And the adoptees are sitting there watching this, and just the alchemy that is happening and the healing that's happening in these rooms is really profound. It's beyond anything I ever imagined would happen. And this is where healing is. It's not in a hospital room. It's not in some sort of like medical system. It is talking with other people that get it.
Mm-hmm. I've heard a quote said, I can't remember who exactly it is, but that healing doesn't happen in isolation. Healing is an act of communion. And that just what you're describing, that for you to feel that way and for the participants to feel that happening together, you can't do it alone. It's too big.
Yeah. Yep. Definitely. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing.
Is there, what words of encouragement, just to close things out, would you offer to an adoptive parent that is trying to support their child who's going through this? I guess we can start there.
Okay, for adoptive parents, I would say how important it is to do our own work. It's great when adoptive parents realize that there is adoption trauma and that their kids might be having some problems. That's great, but let's do our own work. Like, let's not ask our kids to do anything that we're not willing to do ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to reduce using my stupid phone. I'm super hooked on my phone, scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. And, you know, I'm wishing my son would quit cannabis. Well, how would I feel if someone took away my phone right now?
Mm-hmm.
I would be flipping out. So we can't ask our kids to do anything that we're not willing to do ourselves. Mm-hmm. And if we can do it first, whatever that is, whether it's going to therapy, whether it's getting into a meditation practice, whether it's whatever, if we can do that first and show our kids that even as adults, even as, you know, super grown up people, we can still work on things, that shows our kids what's possible and that we are not above them. We are not, we are in it with them, willing to do whatever we're asking them to do.
And how about a message for, like, if Joey could really internalize one message from you and other kids and young adults like Joey, what's your message to them?
I would say to Joey or to any adoptee, I see you. I'm trying to understand as deeply as I possibly can. I see the pain that is clear, and I want to be as helpful as I possibly can.
Well, I really feel like you have done that. You've created a beautiful book, and not just a book, but a community. What's the best place for people to find out all the many different things that you're doing and keep in touch with you?
Thank you so much. Yeah, our website is unravelingadoption.com. That has everything, including the third section of the book is a giant list of resources, and I've included that on our website for free, so you don't even have to buy the book. If you want to read more or find crisis numbers to call, or there's a ton of podcasts and essays about adoption and suicidality that are in the back of that book and other resources. So that's on our website too. You can find out about our events, our conversations, which are monthly discussion circles about adoption and suicidality. Our podcast too is on there. Just unravelingadoption.com.
Amazing. Well, Beth,
Sure.
it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for everything that you have done to bring light to this topic.
Thank you, Alicia. Thank you very much for highlighting the book and for bringing me on. I very much appreciate it. I hope it helps a lot of people.
Thank you so much to Beth, and also thank you to Joey for your willingness to share your story and your experiences to strengthen other adoptive families and to help us learn and hopefully become better equipped to handle challenges, mental health crises, and to better support and help each other.
I just want to reiterate, and Beth said this in the episode, but not long ago in the United States, there was a new phone number developed, 988, that you can call if you are struggling with mental health or if a loved one that you're with is struggling with mental health. Like she talked about, going to the emergency room, may be helpful, but in the case that she experienced and others that we're aware of, it might not always be the right decision. So please remember that.
Yeah, so grateful for the resources that are available. So grateful for Beth sharing her experience. We also wanted to share a couple of quick announcements. So on the podcast before, we've talked about the First Families Project. It's a research project where researchers from two universities are interviewing birth parents from across the United States who have placed a child for adoption since about 1990, and there's compensation for interviews, and everything's confidential, of course. If you're interested in that research, then please visit on Instagram at first_families_project. And we partner with them on some of our posts on Instagram. We will share links for them on our Instagram stories this week too. So if you or someone you know might be interested in participating in that research, we highly encourage that. It's a really great project that's really focused on hearing authentic, genuine experiences from any birth families who are willing to share. We also want to thank Alicia Gallagher for her help with this episode. She has been so instrumental and helpful with our podcast. She volunteered with us for the last year and was just so wonderful to work with. And she is doing other awesome projects now, so we just wanted to really let her know how much we appreciate her. At the podcast, a lot of the work that we do is volunteer-based. We don't make money off of this. It's really a passion project. And so if you are enjoying the podcast and want to help support us, the way to do that is really through buying the Openness Guide for Adoptive Parents. It's available online. If you go to openadoptionproject.org, you can find that there. And all proceeds from the guide go right back into the podcast, paying our podcast fees and helping us stay on the air.
One more thing that you could do to support the podcast is to share it, or at least like it on whatever platform you're on. Give us a rating, write a comment, share it with people that it might help. The more comments that we get, the more ratings that we get, the more it will
hopefully good ratings, right? Yeah.
Right, yeah. The more that it will show up in searches. So if you haven't yet, please go ahead and give us a 5-star review. Like Mama always said, if you can't say something nice, don't say it at all, right?
I mean, that's a nice principle. Maybe not always lived.
But we'd appreciate your help with that too.
Yeah, we are almost to our 4-year anniversary on the podcast, which is so
Coming
exciting.
up quick.
Yep. We love being here. We love having these conversations and learning with you. Thanks for being here so much.